The Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society Podcast.
Welcome to the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society, a podcast dedicated to suspense, crime, and horror stories from the golden age of radio. I'm Eric.
I'm Tim.
And I'm Joshua.
We love mysterious old-time radio stories, but do they stand the test of time? That's what we're here to find out.
We are headed back into our listener library for an episode recommended to us in a message sent by Harrison. Harrison writes, "Hi, Morals. I've been listening to the podcast since I was 18, and you guys have opened my eyes to the amazing world of radio ever since. I've been trying to find something that I'd like to hear you discuss, and I think I found it. The specialty of the house from The Price of Fear." Thank you, Harrison, and you should know that you are not alone in requesting this one. More than one listener shared your curiosity.
Back when the podcast was starting, the very first episode I brought to the table was from The Price of Fear, a BBC series that began with a limited run in 1973. The production's popularity warranted a second run of shows in 1974 and a third that aired in 1983. Of course, what made The Price of Fear so special was the show's star, Vincent Price. By this point, Price was a well-established horror icon thanks to a series of filmed adaptations of Edgar Allan Poe stories, directed by Roger Corman. But long before that, he had a full career on the radio, including appearances on Suspense and Escape. He notably portrayed the title character on The Saint from 1947 to 1951.
During each episode of The Price of Fear, Price played a slightly fictionalized version of himself, a globe-trotting gourmand and devotee of the arts who just happens to continually find himself wrapped up in macabre situations. This particular episode, The Specialty of the House, was adapted from the short story of the same name written by Stanley Ellen. It was first published in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine in 1948 and won a Best First Story Award that year. Before this radio version, the story had been adapted for television by Alfred Hitchcock Presents, broadcast December 13th, 1959.
As you might imagine, Ellen's original 1948 story did not feature Vincent Price as one of its characters. Can this adaptation casually insert the legendary star of ghoulish thrillers into its narrative? We'll find out as we listen to The Specialty of the House from The Price of Fear, first broadcast April 13th, 1974.
It's late at night, and a chill has set in. You're alone, and the only light you see is coming from an antique radio. Listen to the sounds coming from the speaker. Listen to the music, and listen to the voices.
Price of Fear, brought to you by Vincent Price.
Glancing through my morning paper over breakfast today, I noticed that an enterprising gentleman in the catering business has invented a musical hot dog called, would you believe, a humburger. Isn't it amazing the things some people will eat? Food, by the way, is something of a hobby of mine, and I never cease to wonder at the incredible results that can be achieved by a good chef with a few basic ingredients, a little meat, a few vegetables, a glass of wine, a sprig of parsley, and voila. You know, there are few more interesting experiences than being allowed into the kitchen of a really first-class restaurant, to watch a master chef at work. And, of course, this privilege is rarely extended to anyone, which reminds me of an experience I had a few years back. And to give it the right flavor, let's call it Specialty of the House. I was staying in New York at the time, and a friend of mine, Harry Lafler, knowing that I was interested in good food, invited me to dine with him one evening at his favorite restaurant. Harry was by way of being an international advertising man, and knowing the size of his expense account, I had imagined that I was in for an evening at one of New York's plushier night spots. Imagine my surprise, therefore, when I found myself being ushered towards a shabby brownstone building in an almost deserted downtown back street.
Well, here we are. This is Spiero's. What do you think of it?
Well, Harry, I must say, it's not quite what I expected. It is rather dismal, isn't it?
I'll have you know that Spiero's is the restaurant without pretensions. It is the one place in these ghastly neurotic times that has refused to compromise. When you enter Spiero's, you leave the insanity of this hour, of this day, of this year, and you find yourself for a brief span restored in spirit.
You make it sound more like a cathedral than a restaurant.
I wonder if I've done the right thing in bringing you here.
Oh, come on now, Harry. I was only joking.
You see, you are the one person I know with a knowledge of good food.
Thank you.
Knowing about Spiero's and not having an appreciative friend to share it with is like having a unique work of art locked in a room where no one else can see it. Anyway, let's not stand here talking. Let's go in.
Good evening, sir.
Mr. Lafleur and a guest.
Ah, yes, sir. Please come this way, gentlemen. Well,
the waiter led us through a mirrored foyer into a small dining room. It was no size at all, but the half dozen or so guttering gas jets which provided the only illumination threw such a deceptive light that the walls flickered and faded into uncertain distance. There were no more than 8 or 10 tables in the room, and all but one were occupied. The few waiters serving moved amongst them with quiet efficiency. It really was very pleasant. And as soon as we were seated at the vacant table, I said as much to Harry.
There. I knew you'd like it. But wait till you taste the food. By the way, did you notice that there are no women present?
Yes, I did. Isn't that rather odd?
Spiro doesn't encourage them.
Oh.
And I can tell you his method of getting rid of them is very effective.
Excuse me, sir. Do you wish to be served now?
Tell me, is the special being served tonight, waiter?
Oh, I'm so sorry, sir. There is no special this evening.
But it's been a month already. And I had hoped that my friend here...
I'm sorry, sir, but you do understand the difficulties, sir.
Oh, well, what the hell. But I was hoping, Vincent, to introduce you to the greatest treat that Spiro offers.
Oh, never mind. I'm quite sure that whatever we decide upon will be delicious.
Shall I serve at once, sir?
Yes, please.
Very good, sir.
Well, Harry, have you ordered in advance?
No. No, I should have explained. Spiro offers no choice whatsoever.
But suppose we don't like what we're given?
Oh, don't worry. No matter how exacting your taste, you will relish every mouthful. Just think a moment about the advantages of such a system. For instance, instead of a hurly-burly of sweating cooks trying to prepare 100 different dishes, here we have a chef who stands serenely alone, bringing all his culinary arts to bear on one task.
Oh, then you've seen Spiro's kitchen. Tell me, what's it like?
Unfortunately, I can't. I've never seen it. Oh. Believe me, I've tried. In fact, I admit that my desire to see the inside of this particular kitchen has become almost an obsession with me.
Well, have you ever mentioned this to Spiro?
At least a dozen times. But he just shrugs his massive shoulders and smiles. Still, I've never given up hope.
At this point, the waiter reappeared, bearing 2 soup bowls and a small tureen, from which he slowly ladled a measure of clear, thin soup. I must confess that I tasted this soup with some curiosity. It was delicately flavored, bland to the verge of tastelessness. Automatically, I reached for the salt.
Well, what do you think of the soup?
Excellent.
If you'll pardon me for saying so, you don't.
What?
You do not find it excellent. You find it flat and badly in need of salt.
But how did you...
How do I know?
Yes.
Because that was my reaction when I first dined here. But I'm confident that you will make the same discovery as I did. By the time you've finished your soup, your desire for salt will be non-existent.
Well, Harry proved to be quite right. And before I had finished the soup, I was relishing every mouthful of it. It was really wonderful. Harry smiled at me across the table.
Well, do you agree with me now? Mm. Wasn't I right?
Yes, you certainly were.
You will find that the absence of condiments is only one of several noteworthy characteristics which marks Spiro's. I may as well prepare you for the rest. For example, No alcoholic beverages of any sort are served here.
Oh, really, Harry?
Also, there is a ban on the use of tobacco in any form.
Oh, but good Lord, is this a restaurant or a temperance hotel?
You don't understand. By alternating stimulant and narcotic, you seesaw the delicate balance of your taste so violently that it loses its most precious quality, the appreciation of fine food.
Not another word was spoken until we had both finished our main course. Nor was there any need for words in the presence of such food. It was delicious. And it was only with a great effort that I prevented myself from wolfing the lot at one go and establishing myself as a grade A glutton on my very first visit to this amazing restaurant. When we had both finished eating, Harry and I smiled at each other contentedly. We were both aware that we had enjoyed an exceptional culinary experience. Harry, if I had any doubts about Spiro's, I apologize unreservedly. In all your praise of the place, there is not a single word of exaggeration.
Ah, that is only part of the story. You heard me mention the special, which unfortunately was not on tonight's menu. Well, what we've just eaten is as nothing when compared to the absolute delights of that special.
Good Lord, what is it? I mean, nightingale's tongues, fillet of unicorn?
Neither. It is lamb.
Lamb? Oh, come on, you've got to be joking.
If I were to give you in my own unstinted words my opinion of this dish, you would think me insane. That is how deeply the mere thought of it affects me. It is a select portion of the rarest sheep in existence. Lamb Armistan.
Armistan.
A remote and almost unknown place on the border which separates Russia and Afghanistan. From chance remarks dropped by Spiro, I gather that it's hardly more than a plateau which grazes the pitiful remnants of a flock of superb sheep. Spiro, by some means or other, has obtained exclusive rights to this flock, and is therefore the only restaurateur in the world ever to have lamb Armistan on his menu. I can tell you, the appearance of this dish is a very rare occurrence indeed, and nobody ever knows the exact date on which it will be served.
Oh, but surely Spiro could provide some advanced knowledge of this event.
Well, the only objection to that is simply stated. Should advance information slip out, then the professional gluttons, in which this city abounds, would get the opportunity to taste this dish and sooner or later drive out the regular patrons.
You don't mean to say that these few people present are the only ones in the entire city who know of the existence of Spiro's?
In the entire world.
Oh, that's incredible.
It's kept a secret by every single patron, a solemn obligation. By accepting my invitation this evening, you automatically assume that obligation. I hope you can be trusted with it.
Well, if that's the way you want it, Harry, of course I can.
It may sound strange to you indeed. It may border on eccentricity, but I'm a solitary man, and I feel to my depths that this restaurant is both family and friend to me.
I must confess that until that moment, I had never really thought much about Harry's private life. To me, he was a pleasant friend and dining companion, and his private affairs had never really concerned me. Now, hearing him refer to Spiro's in this manner, I almost came to feel sorry for him. By the end of 2 weeks, Harry's invitations for me to join him at Spiro's had become something of a ritual. Now, I am by nature one of those people with a lean and hungry look, but I began to notice that I was rapidly putting on weight. I was, to tell the truth, becoming plump. I began to wonder whether Harry, by no means a lightweight, had also been lean before he started to dine at Spiro's. Thinking the whole thing over, I decided that I would not refuse to eat at the restaurant until I had both tasted the lamb Armistan and also been introduced to the amazing Mr. Spiro. And then one night, a few weeks later, I achieved both these ambitions, and both, I may say, exceeded my expectations.
Ah, good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Tonight is the special, sir.
What?
Well, This is it. The culinary triumph of all times. And faced by it, you are embarrassed by the very emotion it distills.
Yes, I must confess that my heart is certainly beating faster than usual. Tell me, Harry, the other diners, do they feel the same way?
Well, of course they do. Look around you and judge for yourself.
Yes, you're right. Anyway, there's comfort in numbers. It's nice to know that we all have the same basic animal feelings and can anticipate, or should I say, slaver over our meat.
Oh, look, one of our number appears to be in for disappointment. Hmm? Over there, at the end table, the empty seat.
Oh, yes, the stout bald man. Hmm. He's not here tonight. I do believe it's the first dinner he's missed here in weeks.
Rain or shine, crisis or calamity, I don't think he's missed an evening at Spiro's in 10 years. Imagine his disappointment when he finds that he's missed the speciality of the house.
Oh. Mr. Laffler and friend, I am so pleased, so very, very pleased.
Ah, Mrs. Vera.
Tonight, gentlemen, the lamb armistan will be an unqualified success. I myself have been stewing in the miserable kitchen all day, prodding the foolish chef to do everything just so. The just so is the important part, eh? But I see your friend does not know me. An introduction, perhaps.
The words ran in a smooth, fluid eddy. They rippled, they purred, and I found myself hypnotized and could do no more than stare as Harry performed the introductions. Spiro's mouth, the mouth that uncoiled this sinuous monologue, was alarmingly wide, with thin, mobile lips that curled and twisted with every syllable. He had a wide nose and wide-set eyes. It was an amazing face, and somehow I had the feeling that I had seen it before. It was somehow familiar.
I am so very pleased to meet you, Mr. Price. So very, very pleased.
Oh, thank you. How do you do, Mr. Spiro?
You like my little establishment, eh?
Oh, yes.
You have a great treat in store for you today, I assure you.
My friend is by way of being a great admirer of yours, Spiro.
It's true.
Very great compliment. You compliment me with your presence, and I return the compliment with my food, eh? But I assure you, the lamb armistan is far superior to anything of your past experience. All the trouble obtaining it, all the difficulty of preparation, is truly merited.
You know, I've wondered why, with all these difficulties you mention, why you even bothered to present lamb armistan. Surely your other dishes are excellent enough to uphold your reputation.
Yeah, perhaps it is a matter of psychology. Someone discovers a wonder and must share it with the others, eh?
Mm.
Or perhaps it is just a matter of good business.
Well, then, in the light of all this and considering all the conventions you impose on your customers, why don't you turn it into a private club?
So perspicacious. Ah, I will tell you. Because there is more privacy in a public eating place than in the most exclusive club in existence. Here, no one inquires into your affairs. No one desires to know the intimacies of your life. We are not curious about our guests. We welcome you when you are here. We have no regrets when you go. That is the answer, eh?
Yes, I'm sorry. I had no intention of prying.
No, you are not prying. On the contrary, I invite questions.
Don't let Spiro intimidate you. I've known him for years, and I assure you his bark is far worse than his bite. But before you know it, he'll be showing you all the privileges of the house, except inviting you into his precious kitchen, of course.
For that, you may have to wait a little while, I'm afraid.
What did I tell you? Come on now, Spiro. The truth. Has anyone except staff ever stepped into that kitchen of yours?
You see on the wall over there the portrait of one to whom I did that honor.
Hmm?
A dear friend and a patron of long standing.
Where? Oh, yes, there.
Oh.
Who is it?
Oh, it's Andrew Herring, the writer. You know the one, Harry. He used to write those marvelously cynical articles for the New American. And then he took himself off to Mexico, I think it was, and disappeared.
Of course. Here I've been sitting, staring at that picture for years without recognizing it. It must have been a blow for you when your old friend disappeared, Spiro.
It was, I assure you, gentlemen. But I like to think of it this way. He was probably greater in his death than in his life, eh?
Hmm?
Oh, most tragic man.
He often told me that his only happy hours were spent here at this table. Pathetic, is it not? And to think the only favor I could ever show him was to let him witness the mysteries of my humble kitchen.
You know, you seem very certain of his death. After all, as I remember, no evidence has ever turned up to support it.
None at all. Remarkable, eh? Ah, but no more talk, please, gentlemen, for here comes the speciality of the house. Lamb Armistan.
Spiro served the meal himself, taking great care not to lose a single drop of gravy as he sliced the joint, underdone to perfection. He filled the two plates with the chunks of dripping meat.
Ah, gentlemen, bon appétit.
With great deliberation, I took a mouthful of the lamb Armistan. It was magnificent.
Good, eh? Better than you imagined?
It is as impossible for the uninitiated to imagine the delights of lamb Armistan as
for a mortal man to look into his own soul?
Perhaps. Perhaps you have just had a glimpse into your own soul, eh?
Yes, perhaps. And a gratifying picture it made, too. All fang and claw.
Well, I must be going. But sometimes, my friend, when you have nothing better to do, sit perhaps for a little while in a dark room and think of this world and what it is and what it is going to be. Then you must turn your thoughts to the significance of the lamb in religion. It will be so interesting. And now, gentlemen, I have interrupted your meal for too long. Au revoir, gentlemen.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
He's an interesting man, Spiro. Very interesting man. You know, Harry, he reminds me of someone. I just can't think who. You don't think I offended him in any way, do you?
Offended him? No. Goodness, no. He loves that sort of talk. Lamb Armistan is a ritual with him. Get him started, and he'll just go on forever.
It was a month later that it finally came to me exactly who it was that Spiro reminded me of. And when it did, I laughed out loud. Of course, Spiro reminded me of the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland. You remember, the cat only grinned when it saw Alice. It looked very good-natured, she thought. Still, it had very long claws and a great many teeth, so she felt that it ought to be treated with respect. I mentioned this to Harry that night as we were walking along that dismal street that led to Spiro's.
You may be right, but I'm not a fit judge. Anyway, it's a long time since I read Alice in Wonderland. A very long time.
Help!
What?
Help!
Look there. Outside Spiro's. Isn't that one of the waiters?
Yes.
Looks as though he's in trouble.
He's being attacked. Come on. Yes.
Help! Goddamn pickpocket. Push me, will you? You're looking for a goddamn fight, huh? Well, you got one, mister.
Let me go. Let me go.
Not yet, you lousy old creep.
Well, what's going on here?
Help me, sir. This man, he's drunk. He tried to stab me.
Oh, drunk, am I? Oh, we'll... Hey, you dirty...
Hey, grab him, Harry. Quick, look out for that knife.
Let go of him. Do you hear? Let go.
Hey, what the hell's happening here? No. I'll cut your goddamn throat, mister.
No, you don't. Oh.
Boy, is he all right, do you think? That was some punch, Harry.
Well, I think he's stunned. He banged his head as he fell.
Yeah, well, in any case, it's a job for the police.
No, no, sir.
What?
No police. Mr. Spiro does not like police.
Oh, now, wait.
I beg you, no police.
Anyway, he's coming around. Oh, he'll be all right. But what started all this anyway?
I push against him accidentally, and he accused me of robbing him. He's drunk, sir.
You can say that again. Well, now, you go inside and get cleaned up. We'll see to him.
Thank you, sir. To you, I owe my life. If there is anything I can do to repay you.
You just cut along, and if Mrs. Vera has any questions, you tell him to see me.
Yes, sir. You saved my life. Thank you, sir.
And with that, the waiter disappeared into the restaurant. Well, after all the excitement and kerfuffle of that incident, I must confess that I found I had quite an appetite. And as soon as we were comfortably seated in the restaurant, Harry and I debated with some trepidation as to whether or not we could expect the special lamb Armistan that evening. Soon our regular waiter appeared and carefully set two tumblers on the table. We almost simultaneously inquired after the special.
No, sir. I'm sorry, sir. No special tonight.
Oh, hell, just my luck. And I'll probably miss out next time, too.
Why, Harry? You going away?
Yes, damn it. I'm off to South America for a month or two in order to mount a new campaign for some very rich clients.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. When do you leave?
Tonight. I managed to wangle some reservations. This was intended to be in the nature of a farewell celebration.
Oh, and no special. What a shame.
Just my luck.
Well, I'm going to miss you, Harry. I have enjoyed our evenings together, and these little dinners of ours have, well, they've come to mean a great deal to me.
Shall I serve now, sir?
Of course. I didn't realize you were waiting.
Shortly afterwards, the waiter served us, and we turned our attention to our dinner. Harry finished his quickly and continued to bemoan his fate and to regret loudly the thought of missing Lamb Armistan during his trip. Then, just as I finished my meal, a waiter leaned over to take Harry's plate. It wasn't our usual waiter, but the man who we had rescued from the drunken sailor. I asked him how he was feeling, but to my surprise, he completely ignored me, and with the air of a man under great strain, he whispered to Harry,
"My life. I owe it to you. I can't repay you."
"Well, you have repaid me with your thanks. Please, let's hear no more about it."
"But I will help you, sir, even if you don't want me to. Do not go into the kitchen tonight."
"Huh?"
"My life for yours, sir. Tonight or any night, do not go into Spiro's kitchen."
"Why shouldn't I go into the kitchen? Don't be absurd."
"What's going on here?"
"Is everything all right, gentlemen?"
"Ah, good evening, Spiro. This man is a little unnerved, I think."
"Ah, yes. An unfortunate experience."
"He's saying something about my not visiting your kitchen. What's it all about? Do you know what he means?"
"But of course. He was giving you good advice. It so happens that my too emotional chef heard some rumor that I might have a guest in the kitchen tonight. He flew into a fearful rage and even threatened to give his notice on the spot. However, have no fear. I have succeeded in showing him what a signal honor it is to have a true connoisseur observe him at his work firsthand. That is all." "No, Sancho, you are at the wrong table. See that it does not happen again."
The waiter slunk away without daring to raise his eyes, and Spiro drew up a chair to the table. He seated himself and drew his hand lightly over his hair.
"My invitation for you to visit my humble kitchen, I had hoped, Mr. Lafleur, to be a surprise, but now the surprise is gone, and all that is left is the invitation."
"Are you serious? Do you mean that at last we really are to witness the preparation of food in your kitchen tonight?"
No, Mr. Lafleur, not both. I am faced with a dilemma of great proportions, gentlemen. You, Mr. Lafleur, have been my guest for 10 years, but our friend here..."
"Oh, Mr. Spiro, I really understand perfectly. I mean, this invitation is solely to Harry here, and naturally, my presence is embarrassing." "Well, look, no, wait a minute. As it happens, I do have another engagement for later, and I must be on my way anyhow. So, you see, there's no dilemma at all, really."
"Absolutely not. That wouldn't be fair at all. No. Surely, Spiro, you can make an exception on this one occasion."
"I'm very sorry, sir."
"Harry, I am not going to sit here and spoil your great adventure, believe me. And then just think of that ferocious chef. I'm sure he's just dying to get his cleaver into you."
"So humorous.
So I'll just say goodbye now and leave you to Spiro. I'm sure he'll take pains to give you a good show."
"Well, that's good of you, Vincent. Thanks. I hope you continue to dine here while I'm away."
"Oh, and have a good trip, Harry."
"Thank you. Bye now."
"I will expect you, Mr. Price. Au revoir."
"Au revoir." And so I left them to it, the smiling Spiro and Harry Lafleur, about to realize his greatest ambition. On the way out, I stopped in the foyer to collect my coat, and as I was straightening my tie,
I caught a glimpse in the mirror of Harry and Spiro, already at the kitchen door. Spiro was holding it open, invitingly wide, with one hand, while the other hand rested lightly on Harry's plump, meaty shoulder, squeezing it ever so gently, almost lovingly, rather in the way a housewife squeezes a prime fat turkey before she puts it into the oven. I've never seen or heard of Harry Lafler again. Shortly afterwards, I left New York in order to do some filming in England. I've not been back since, and therefore I have never had the opportunity of dining again at Spiro's, nor of renewing my acquaintance with its mysterious owner. In the intervening years, however, my interest in food and its preparation has increased, and I can now create and experiment with recipes of my own. But I must confess that even in my wildest flights of culinary fancy, I have never yet dared to attempt lamb Amistad.
That was Vincent Price bringing you The Price of Fear. Co-starring in the speciality of the house was Hugh Burden, with Francis DeWolf, Vernon Joyner, and William Slay. The speciality of the house was first recounted by Stanley Ellin, dramatized by Barry Campbell, and produced by John Dyers.
That was Specialty of the House from The Price of Fear. Here on the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society podcast. Once again, I'm Aaron.
I'm Tim.
And I'm Joshua.
And that was a listener recommendation from Harrison.
And so many other listeners. I have lost a lot of them for years. This has been one of our most requested episodes, frankly.
I did not know that till this very moment. Then again, I don't read the requests. Yeah, so you just tell me.
You don't know anything at all.
Well, listen. So Harrison's been listening since he was 18, and
he's 36 now. Right, even exactly. Though we've only done the podcast for 4 years, it's
that was
weird.
My fear is that he was in his 40s, and I had really lost track of time. Yeah. But the thing is, I've been listening since I was 18.
Yeah,
I'm now 18 and a half.
Some disturbing Harlan Ellison story. Jeff D is 36. You know, for Harlan Ellison fans, we'll think that's really funny, by the way, guys.
So
tough crowd here.
Should we hold for laughs for them? So Harrison and so many others wanted to hear this, and so many requests, and it's obviously deeply loved. I should probably just let someone else start this conversation.
I'll start this.
Yeah.
Because before I knew it was requested so many times, I listened to this as a possible thing to bring to the podcast and decided, meh. And now listening to it a second time, I literally find myself being that guy sitting across from young me at the table saying, I know you're reaching for the salt. I know you think this is bland.
That's a really interesting analogy, Tim.
The whole thing gelled me seeing it that way of like, I'll go on and on.
Well, first, I just want to say this because I think it's really important that we put this in some kind of perspective. We just listened to Vincent Price eat another human being. Just thought I would put that out there. That's pretty amazing.
He does kind of let that go.
Not only does he eat another human being, but he declares it magnificent. In all seriousness, I give Vincent Price a lot of credit for doing a play in which he plays himself eating another human being.
Wait a minute. Is that what happened?
It is alarming. He's so casual about it, but
yeah.
It's an interesting thing you said, Tim, about the analogy of them possibly describing actually you as a listener going through this show.
Once that thought struck me, like the whole thing follows along of they don't do in the story smoking or drinking, and there's not a lot of flashy gore or anything in this. And particularly once I read the story that it is based on, which I think even more so, sort of looks like this sort of bland, when you hear the title, especially to the house, like, is it people? Are they eating people? Yeah. But in the actual execution, it's so rich, I thought, the second time through.
Right. And now that you just said that, like, they're kind of explaining their own story in a certain way.
And I don't know how much of that I was like, I'm reaching because I love to reach. But
right.
There's a lot of, it holds together pretty well, this thought of it is describing itself as a horror story.
Yeah.
And I think we also have to take the perspective that in, what was it, 1940, when the story was published, 1940-something.
Mm-hmm. Eating people was illegal.
It still is.
I didn't do any research.
We're not that progressive. But I don't think people's mind would have went from especially the house to cannibalism the way it does today. Okay. I mean, I agree with you. Mine did too. I saw the title and went, oh, is this going to be a cannibalism thing? Okay. Blase. But no, I think the genius in here to me is pairing it with Vincent Price, who is publicly known as this connoisseur of fine food.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some of the Price of Fear stories, there is some clumsiness in finding the way, not all of them, but some of them, finding a way to insert Vincent Price into the story in a way that...
That works for him.
Yeah, that works for him, but doesn't detract from the story you're trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And here, not only does he fit seamlessly into this story, it actually, I think, enriches it, because we as an audience know that Vincent Price loves food in real life. And so there's this added level of horror here.
As opposed to the rest of us.
Well, it authenticates the horror if Vincent Price is there and it seems like something that you actually believe that he in real life would do, as opposed to some of the other episodes where you realize, well, this probably has never happened to Vincent Price. But you could actually see Vincent Price getting suckered into going to some weird hole-in-the-wall club that serves human flesh. It adds to that creeping sense of horror by making it seem possibly more real, I guess.
For me, the horror came from two things. One, something that happened in real time, and two, something that I thought about minutes after it was over. And that is, the real time thing is Vincent Price's blasé reaction to, well, I never saw him, and you get the feeling that he has figured out that, yes, we were eating people, okay? Mm-hmm. And he didn't seem, as Joshua said, too upset over the fact...
Didn't call the police or anything.
Or pump his stomach or, you know, get sickened by it. It's like, yeah, that happened. But in retrospect, after thinking about it, am I right? In that moment where he was adamantly saying, No. This is your deal, man. You've been wanting to see this kitchen, and he doesn't want me to go in there, and I'll gladly leave, right? And he just goes on and on. No, you should. Well, let's get you in there, too. No. I'm fine. Go live out your life dream. I thought about that and went, does he know right then and there?
He threw him under the cannibal bus.
Right. And when you think about it that way, it becomes insidious, where you go, oh, Vincent Price just figured this out and is going, yeah, buddy. Because remember, they did get the warning.
Yeah.
Don't go in there. What if Vincent Price's character, which wasn't expanded upon, I have nothing to base this on, but what if he did put two and two together, and instead of going, hey, man, maybe we should rethink this. Bill over here is gone. He's here every night, and he was fat. And, you know, and all of these things, he just went, no, you should go in. And I'm going to leave as fast as I possibly can. What do you guys think of that being the intent of the writing? Is that what happened? Is that what they want us to think?
That's plausible, because, I mean, the guy goes in because he gets the warning and he ignores it. And so I can see Vincent Price going, you got your shot. You got your warning. I'm leaving.
Right. And not blowing his cover, because that's a dangerous human being and I'm going to play dumb.
I think there's another reading as appealing as your reading is, where Vincent Price earlier in the show has a rare moment of empathy for his friend. Mm-hmm. Because usually Vincent Price is narrating it. He is this kind of liaison between the listener and the horror. And here he takes a moment to go like, oh, I feel bad for this guy who says the people at this restaurant are like my family and my friends. And I think that is intended to set up that moment at the end where Vincent Price, who is a suave gentleman, would never create a scene at a restaurant.
Right.
And he does feel bad, and he would hate to be in the way of his friend finally reaching his, what I think he calls earlier, an obsession, his goal to get into the kitchen. So I think narratively, we're intended to think that Vincent Price figures it out later in order to retain some semblance of respect for Vincent Price. However, I much prefer your reading of it. Because clearly, by his own description, he's telling the story in the past tense, and there's no way he doesn't know at the end when he's describing Spiro's hand patting Lafleur lightly on his plump, meaty shoulder, squeezing it ever so gently, basically like a housewife squeezes a prime fat turkey before she puts it in the oven.
Okay, so here's my argument. If he's telling this in the future, and this is his memory of the past, he remembers details like him squeezing him and touching him like a turkey and all that, you know, which means... Which means that in the...
Me like a turkey.
Which means...
That's our new threadless t-shirt.
Touch me like a turkey. Which means that in the moment he was aware. I'm telling you that we're supposed to think...
No, it's a persuasive argument, I agree, but I think you can also remember it in hindsight and go, oh.
Oh, these details... Jump at me now.
Yeah.
Oh, well, sure. But how about if we believe the other way?
But also you're dealing with a story that I think when it was originally written, as well as even in this version from 1974, it wants to retain both for reasons of horror and probably reasons for listener outrage, some plausible deniability, explicitly stated... We are eating people.
But yes, but here's the deal. To save his own ass, so to speak, he pretends to not know, but he knows because he's got to get out of there because these are dangerous people and never go back to this restaurant again.
No, you've sold me. I'm willing to buy your argument.
But there's some more going on here. In this adaptation, I think they strongly imply that Vincent Price could never go back here because he can't afford it. He mentioned specifically this guy's marketing. He has a lot of money, and the implication is that he is paying for these dinners. I read the story, too. Bum, bum, bum.
This is so freeing for me that you read this story.
Yeah, I did, too.
Inserting Vincent Price into the story gives you all kinds of little gifts to it, you also do lose a few things in that trade-off. The main two characters in the story are, one, the Vincent Price figure works for the other guy. And so the dynamic is like, I'm introducing you to this world, I'm taking care of you, you're on your way up. And at the very end, when he's going to be taken into the kitchen, he says, I'm going away on a trip. While I'm gone, you're in charge. I'm paraphrasing.
So he does have motivation to let him get eaten.
Yes, and also that he can come back to this restaurant if he wants because he's now got the spot the old boss previously had. Also, the very last line is just simply like, I saw him open the door and put his hand on his meaty shoulder, and that's it. This version spices it a little.
And I would have to assume you would have to be less explicit when this story was originally written.
I like that better. I like that open-endedness, not hitting us over the head with a hammer. Get it? They ate him. Instead of put his hand on his meaty shoulder.
And if I remember right, they were also putting his picture up next to the other guys.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not subtle either in the story. They've made it very clear that the people who disappear after becoming fat on Spiro's food. This is the day Vincent Price got fat. This is the sequel to the day Sinatra got fat.
All those celebrity photos in some of those L.A. restaurants.
Yep, all eaten.
I'm having some Phyllis Diller.
Not as tough as I thought it would be. But it is a really well done story because I don't want to jump to the vote yet, but I will give enough away to say that I think it stands the test of time, despite the, for me, despite the fact that, like Tim, especially the house, they're going to eat people.
Eating people. Yep.
But it is so expertly escalated.
Mm-hmm.
And each little crumb,
so to speak,
gets both the listener and Vincent Price closer to that aha moment. And as Eric has brought up, it's a little vague in a nice way when Vincent Price has that aha moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, my love of Vincent Price adds to this for me. And so there's that little extra hook here for me, even though I know that it...
Does your love of Vincent Price make you think, oh, he knew from the beginning? He knew before he... He knew before he tucked in, like, I'm meeting some people here. I'm Or does it mean, does it tend to make you think he knew at the last minute?
I want to think he, like, walked out of the restaurant and went, wait a second.
Now I'm even further down the line. Tim, I really like the idea that he knew when he walked up to that brownstone. They're eating people in here, and I'm going to
eat him. But that's people.
In the final lines of his narration, he says, even in the wildest flights of culinary fancy, I have never yet dared to attempt lamb Armistan. But he says, yet. Right. He does not take cannibalism off the table, as it were. He's open to these experiences should the opportunity arise. It's just a really good use of the Price of Fear format.
I am so struck by Tim's first thought of them commenting on the pace and the style of the story through food. And Joshua just said, as they feed you the story crumb by crumb. And yeah. I was like, it just never ends, does it?
No.
And I don't know if you're right, if they did that on purpose, but oh my God, it's like they're talking to you. Hang with the story, everybody. Hang with it.
Because it does tell its story in that style of there's nothing flashy, there's nothing overt. It's just, and I did this reading on Ellen, and Anthony Ellen, am I getting the name right? Doesn't matter. that he was this perfectionist writer, that he would rewrite the first paragraph 40 times. Mm. So he did not make mistakes in his story.
Been there. No. No, I have not been there.
Eric doesn't even write his first paragraph once.
My middle name should be That'll Do. What does my wife call me? B+ and out the door.
Oh, she's generous.
Yeah. I'll see you heading out the door as someone's patting my back on the way into the kitchen. Eric?
B+ and you have a meaty shoulder. But the other fascinating element, and I'm curious because I'm going to confess, this is so liberating. I did not read the short story.
Wow! Said again,
I did not read the short story. I ran out of time. But I'm fascinated by the little bits of Spiro's strange hints that he drops for his motivation, A, for doing this, and B, he seems to want to tell them or hint at the fact that this might be human meat when he's talking about the weird line, like, go sit in a dark room and think what this means for you and what it means for the world and what the lamb means in religion. And it starts to get really creepy.
What they represented the story in the adaptation is the story.
Obviously, lambs in religion represent innocence and purity sacrificed for sins. And here right. We have this gluttony, right? They're just getting fatter right. and fatter. And it seems to imply that in some way, at least, Spiro sees this as some kind of sacrament or holy experience that he is providing for people.
Yeah.
And there's something to the loneliness and isolation of its guests. In this adaptation, they talk about, like, there's no women allowed, and they sort of allude to the way in which he...
Yes, I was going to ask that, because it then never gets to... They get interrupted by the waiter, and he goes, and he has a great way of chasing off women.
So they tell it in the story that some guest brought a woman with him, and they got no service. And, like, no one came to take their order. They were just, you sit here until you get the message.
Wow. It's one of those rare times where sexism works for you. Because, yeah, you don't get to eat people.
That's true. Why can
that is
women...
an outstanding question.
Why were women not allowed to partake in the...
Well, I think, again, it goes...
Was this Catholic thing? Were they Catholics? No. That was supposed to be funny.
Again, I don't know. You're B-plussing out the door. But he seems to feel, Spiro, that he is somehow has this grand plan, that he is doing something great.
There's other little details in there as well, that the kitchen chef handles every dish except the lamb, and that Spiro is the guy who does the lamb.
And he says of the writer on the wall, who Vincent Price seems to think ran away to Mexico, that he was greater in death than life, which goes back to that sacrificial lamb idea.
Also, that when it was told to the chef that they would have a visitor in the kitchen, he threatens to quit. In retrospect, sounds like, no, I'm not cooking up another human, or I'm not going to part.
That was just cover from Spiro, because the waiter who they saved from the drunk swearing knife guy told them not to go into the kitchen. And so Spiro made that up on the moment to cover for why the waiter said, don't go in the kitchen.
Ah, I thought perhaps there was a conflict with the chef who... Yeah. Was like,
oh. You imagine it was the Swedish chef in there from the Mojo.
Not going to kill the... Bork, 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 bork.
I'm sure the chef would be like, oh, especially the house, I get the night off.
Well, any other thoughts on this, gentleman, before we send it to a vote?
One more piece of evidence for Eric's theory. I'm reluctant to support it, but... That nice exchange when Vincent Price describes in great kind of creepy detail Spiro's smile.
Yes.
And he's like, who does that remind me of? And then later he realizes the Cheshire Cat, and how that smile is hiding something dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a case to be made there when he has the aha moment about the Cheshire Cat where he...
Cannibals!
Yeah, you know... That, straight line from Cheshire Cat to cannibals. All right, maybe it's not great evidence, but it's more evidence that he is seeing something under the surface.
Yes. Well, let's send it to a vote. Tim, you can start.
Yeah.
Because you love Vincent Price.
I do love Vincent Price. I might be just high on this newfound joy of this episode, having gone back to re-listen to it and discovered, like, it suckered me in a way that I enjoyed. So I'll stop myself sort of calling it a classic, but it's so good.
Oh, I will call it a post-Golden Age classic. Mm. I think it's just a perfect blending of Price's two personas, the debonair connoisseur of fine dining and the debonair connoisseur of horror. And he kind of blends this together as this guy who navigates you through this story. And his... dispassionate but descriptive kind of narration allows you just that right amount of distance, because otherwise this would be a pretty like down the line body horror thing, but it's almost becomes in places like a dark comedy with Vincent Price's inclusion in it. And I just think there are just so many different facets to it, and it is so deftly done that I'm going to say classic.
All right.
What am I voting on? My take on it?
Vote my take on it. Say classic again.
I mean, the ending. Is Vincent aware or is he not?
I feel with all sort of literary analysis like that, there is what evidence you have, and you have some good evidence, and then there's what you like believing.
Right. As it started, I thought, oh, this could use some salt. And as it went on, and on and on.
She's got fatter and fatter.
I ended up saying, this really could have used some salt. I'm really going to go out on a limb here because I know how many people love this. And I know you two love it. Not my deal.
Would you give it a B+?
I'd give it a B+.
Wait, come back, Eric. Where are you going? Oh, he's out the door.
I do like my take on Vincent knowing, but even with that, it was slow and a lot of food talk. And I knew what was coming the whole time, and I thought it was well done, but I didn't.
That's why find you're not allowed in that restaurant.
Because I'm a woman.
Like, women and Eric. They can't come in this restaurant.
So
it's people.
I'm sure a lot of people are really mad at me right now, but
and a lot of people are going, I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. It was fine. Anyway. Tim, tell them stuff.
Hey,
quick.
Please go visit.
Save me.
GhoulishDiets.com, home of this podcast. There's a lot of other episodes there you can check out. You can also leave comments. You can send us messages if you'd like to request an episode that Eric won't like. No. You can link to our social media pages. You can link to our Threadless store. And you can link to our Patreon page.
Yes, go to patreon.com/themorals and please support this podcast. There's no benefits for cannibals yet.
Yet.
See, I'm just like Vincent Price. I'm keeping my options open. But we have all sorts of great options. And I think the best part of Patreon is that we have this community that we get to build with listeners and get to know them better, and they get to communicate with each other. We have, I keep mentioning Discord because it's a lot of fun. So listeners get to communicate with each other, get to communicate with me. I was just having a conversation with a listener on my way over here. Hi, Wayman.
Oh.
And so please, if you would like to be a part of our exclusive gated community. I undermined it again tonight.
We can only seat so many people in our Discord.
Please go to patreon.com/themorals and support us.
And I would like to make a suggestion for Threadless Needs Salt t-shirt. And I think Get to the Castle and Needs Salt are our two new catchphrases.
Yeah. All right. All right.
I just made that happen. Okay. Hey, if you'd like
get
to see...
Get to the salty castle. It's gross.
Stare into the embers. Different podcast. All right. If you'd like to see us performing live, we do audio theater, recreations of old-time radio shows, and a lot of our own original work, doing audio drama on the stage. And come see us perform live. Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society performs monthly. And you can find out where we're at by going to ghoulishdelights.com and what we're performing this month, also at mysteriousoldradiolisteningsociety.com. And if you're not in the neighborhood of where we're performing, please buy a ticket and watch us virtually online, and because we do live stream it. Is that the right word? Live stream?
Sure.
Is that what we do? Okay. We.
It's too late in the podcast to argue with you.
Yes, so we'll be stream discording it. Hey, what's coming up next?
Your pick, Eric.
Oh, it is my pick. That's right. We're going to be doing an episode of Appointment with Fear, and we're going to do the story, The Pit and the Pendulum.
Never heard of it.
Until then.
Look out!
We just listened to Vincent Price eat another human being.